Hi, this is Joe Lindsley. Welcome to our Land of the Free podcast with Ukrainska Pravda here in the studios in Kyiv. I've just arrived from Kharkiv and very honored to talk here with a Ukrainian legend, Serhiy Stakhovsky, world-class tennis player, winemaker, and soldier. You think of like Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. Tennis player, winemaker, and soldier. Welcome, Serhiy.
Hi, very nice to be here. Thanks for the invite, actually.
This is the land of the free. Stories of life and liberty in a time of war.
And we're here in your hometown, of course, in Kyiv. Serhiy, you have, you know, in your tennis career, you've had a storied tennis career. You defeated Roger Federer when he was number one in the world at Wimbledon. He was defending Wimbledon champion in 2013.
I think he was number two.
He's number two, but he was the defending champ.
Yeah, he was defending champ.
Yeah, and you defeated him in 2013. Yeah.
And then he won the next year.
Yeah, okay, of course, yeah, but it was you've had a storied and successful career, and then in addition to your tennis exploits, which we'll talk about, you started making wine, I think, in 2018. Yeah. I've been to your vineyard, and it's a beautiful, fantastic place in Transcarpathia.
Zakarpathia.
Thank
yes.
you.
Yes, we're going to stay to the local names.
It's very essential. That's why we're having these conversations, to correct the Americans when we say incorrect things about this country. And also, in addition to those professions, when the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine began, you signed up as a soldier. And we'll talk about that and your experience. I think you were near Bakhmut and many places.
Yeah, pretty much.
So here you are on February 24th, 2022, give or take, world-class tennis player, you know, living in this elite world, an elite athlete, going to the world's most famous tournaments, making fantastic wine. It's a good life.
It's
hard
life.
Work. But then what happens for you on the 24th?
Well, to be exact, if we're talking exact, I finished my singles career in January 2022 in Australian Open. And basically my plan was, I had a few big projects coming up, which I was building up, including wine, including tennis club. We were building a massive project for Ukrainian Olympic team, kind of Team USA, but in Ukraine. And I was honored and pretty much with that task in terms of forming the idea and forming the group of individuals who would be running this project. And we were all basically clear to go. March 3rd, 2022, we were supposed to sign an agreement a memorandum between the president, Minister of Sports, and us as an organization, which will be doing it. So for me, basically life was busy and interesting. 24th of February, woke up in Dubai. I was on vacation with my kids. And I was full. I don't know how to describe. You don't believe. You don't believe what you see on the TV. And I remember clearly it was, I think it was BBC or CNN. God forbid, I forgot. But I have it on a video somewhere. And I wake up and you see the Kyiv skyline. It's still dark, and you see the light of explosion in the dark, in different directions. It was, of course, after my parents called me and said that they hear explosions, and we live not far from Bucha and Irpin in Bilohorodka. It's in the direction of Zhytomyr Highway, very close. So, yeah, it was disbelief. It was pure disbelief. I couldn't really, because I never experienced wars, thank God, a lot of citizens of the world didn't. You didn't know how fast it can end, how quick, I mean, what's going to happen in general, you know, how fast Russia can dominate or cannot, or how long can we defend. This all things where you're uncertain of is just insane. And then, you know, you hear, oh, they're already moving in Kherson, or they're already in Sumy, or they're in Chernihiv, or they're coming into Kyiv. And you're like, you're completely, basically nonstop on the telephone, on the iPad, and trying to just locate, calling all your friends who's where, everybody's safe. And, you know, you don't know the outcome. You don't know what's going to happen next. And at that time, you know, the level of unity in between different ranks and just people, ordinary people, was just insane.
And when did you come back to Ukraine?
So for me, of course, it was not at that time. For me, it was not a question that I'm going to come back. But the question arose is that we lived at that time in Budapest. And how long Ukraine can stand.
Yeah.
Because for me, I understand clearly that I'm on a blacklist of Russia. I mean, this is obvious, and it was prior to the full invasion. I'm pretty sure that my name rose up quite a few times for them. So if Ukraine is not able to stand, I am certain and I'm sure that, you know, there's no stopping Russia. And it's not a problem for them to cross the border with Europe, because they know that they can dominate the small European countries like the Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and then, you know, Slovakia and Hungary. And Hungary would maybe even fold in themselves. So where would my kids be safe? Where I'll be safe? And the question arose, and I started to look for the place for them in Dubai. Of course, literally in a matter of minutes, all the available apartments and hotels in Dubai were fully booked. You couldn't get anything. All the things you could get was just ludicrous prices. So we decided to stay a few days there to see what's going to happen. At that time, we were there because my very close friend and the godfather of my youngest son, Sergei Rebrov, was coaching one of the teams in Dubai. Now he's a head coach of Ukraine national team. So we knew that in case we needed to extend, we could stay with them for some time. But then after the first day and then on the second day, I've seen that, you know, we start to gain some ground. We start to resist fiercely in some directions. And we start to see that actually, you know, they are in a more chaos than we are. So I understood that, you know, it's not going to be that fast. They're not going to be able to roll over so quickly, and Ukraine will resist. And you know, a lot of Ukrainians are resisting. So, you know, there's time. So we took a flight on the 26th, we took a flight back to Budapest. I got my kids home. I unpacked them. I took a backpack with some documents and basically left. I drove from Budapest to Bratislava because I have a lot of friends, because I used to live there, and basically all my, I would say, friends are from there predominantly. I have literally very few people I talk to in Hungary. And they already knew, they already had a heads up. So I came there. They are from military environment as well, because my, I would say, circle of friends is much bigger there. So they packed me. I had no idea what I needed. So they packed me, you know, with a multi-tool, with shoes, with basically,
all
I was like, you need this. I'm like, okay, I need this.
These are your Slovakian friends.
Yes. Yeah. And then on top, I have a very good friend who has a company which produces a ceramic bulletproof plate. And he came around and he gave me, I think, 3 or 4 vests already with the plates inside, which I want to thank again to him, because of course after that we did buy a bulk of him, so it was real help. And basically another friend took me all the way to Slovakia and Ukrainian border. Of course I had to sign docs. I went to my banker, I signed the docs that in case something happens to me that you know, my ex-wife gets all the accounts accessible.
I mean, that's what you're thinking. As you're, as you're crossing that border, you're feeling this could be...
Yeah, I didn't know where I'm going to. Yeah. So, of course, I needed to settle the at least the legal part straight, so there's no problems for my family to, for my kids to continue if something happens to me. And basically, he drove me to the border. It was a long drive because from Bratislava, we drove all the way to Ubla, which is about 500 kilometers. On the way, I've stopped by to see my mother. She just crossed the border out, so we met in a gas station, and then I went on. The friend dropped me the closest point, like 20 minutes from the crossing, and from there I went on foot with 2 bags and I think 2 or 3 backpacks across the border. And there was another friend of mine waiting for me on the other side because he drove his family to the border and his in-laws, and they came in by 2 cars. So we took 1 car back to Kyiv. It was super, super funny because, you know, a Mini Cooper, bluish Mini Cooper driving back towards Kyiv, fully packed with...
military gear.
Military gear, non-lethal military gear.
What was your... in your mind, what had you decided what you wanted to do at that point? Or you were just saying, I'm just going to show up and see?
I think that in Kyiv I have a weapon. So I was awarded a pistol, I think back in 2015, by the Ministry of Internal Affairs. So I knew that my only goal basically got to Kyiv, got to my pistol, you know, so at least I have a gun in my hand. Then we can see. And my family at that time, when I started to leave, my mother was still in Kyiv and my brother's family. But then they left and my brother and my father stayed in Kyiv. So I, at least what I needed, I wanted to do is, you know, to come to see my parents, my father and my brother, and then we will decide what to go on next. But already on the way, of course, first I got... Actually, when it all happened, I got a call from my also another very close friend who is a very famous businessman in Ukraine, Selod Kozhemiako. He is the basic creator of the 13th Brigade of National Guard, Khartia. And he has four kids, and he was skiing in Austria at that time with them. And basically, we came back together. But he was a different beast. I mean, I was basically coming into not understanding what to go. He was already geared up. All of his weapons were already in Lviv. He evacuated them prior to the war. And he already had a few guys, you know, with the cars in Lviv. So he was a beast, you know. It was a funny to watch when there was, you know, two SUVs moving and there was a Mini Cooper tingling behind them. And then in Vin, we drove together. We get to Vinnytsia. And Vinnytsia, he offered me to go to Kharkiv. He was super anxious to get to Kharkiv because he wasn't sure that it's 28th of February because we crossed the border at night. I crossed the border at night and we got in the morning to Lviv. And at that time, driving through Ukraine was a whole different level because every single small city would have their own checkpoints, you know. So it really slowed up. It was no cars on the highway almost in that direction, but you still had to stop and he still present the documents. And Vinnytsia, he told me, like, you know, come with me to Kharkiv. I said, Seva, I mean, if something happens, I mean, I'm not from Kharkiv. I have no idea how the city or whatever. And I am from Kyiv. So, I mean, you know, I'm going to go. So, okay, you know, I go to Kharkiv. You go wherever you need to go. And he gave me a heads up who I can call out of his friends and out of our mutual friends, which I, you know, at that time didn't know that they already grew up to such ranks. And basically, yeah, I turned up in Kyiv. Immediately, I called our mutual friend and, you know, I came just kind of, you know, to say hi and to understand what's going to happen. And instead of that, I was given a weapon, you know, sign up and said, okay, if you want, you can stay here or you can, you know. And that's basically how I joined the unofficially territorial defense, officially the Center of Special Operation Alpha.
And I don't know how much you can talk about your experience. Now you can't.
Yeah, now they free me up a bit.
All of a sudden, so you end up in Donbass, I think, right, or near Bakhmut or in Bakhmut, and you know, what was there? I mean, you're used to some of, you know, being some of the most extraordinary sporting venues in the world. You know, great moments at Wimbledon, and. Also, you're a professional athlete, so you're used to, you know, being at the extreme of excellence and you know, you're used to extreme situations, but usually in a very glorified setting. So was there a moment, like, what was your first moment of saying, what the hell is going on? Were you there in battle or whatever your missions were?
No, glorifying. I started my career with a very low perspective of actually making it big because my family is a regular family. My father's a doctor, okay? He's now a professor of urology, but in general, you know, it's not a kind of a setup in Ukraine that gives you the opportunity to play tennis. So for me, sleeping on a floor, four in a room somewhere in Uzbekistan is a normal thing because that's what I went through.
As you were building your tennis career.
I was building my when I was young. So for me, kind of, you know, all these kind of tough conditions to live in was not that tough. The biggest issue is when you actually come to the front line and the first time you experience it is actually when you have to go to the toilet. And there's no toilet, you know, because the water pipes doesn't work, you know, there's no electricity. And that's, you know, that's when you're like, oh, shit. And it's not that you can go outside because it's, you know, it's round. So you have to go somewhere inside. And I mean, it's the first thing which hits you, you know. And then, of course, because you're eating all these MREs, which ready to eat, you know, you don't have any you get occasionally some warm food which is actually cooked, you know, your stomach starts to behave in most interesting ways. So it is kind of that, you know, that will hit you with it. But in general, yeah, of course, the shelling, the rounds, you know, the incomings. Yeah, there's a lot of things which you need to get used to.
But it's true. I mean, this is, you know, talking to an audience that's never been in something like that. Like, you know, the first thing you mentioned is very...
Because, I mean, you know, of course, the shelling, the explosions, the death, the wounded, it's all there. But I was exposed to it slowly, you know, so it was pretty decent conditions where we stayed in Kyiv. We actually had great conditions when we stayed in Kyiv. So the first, I would say, 2.5 months. Then we had occasional trips to Kharkiv and to Barvinkovo. That was still kind of, you know, manageable. It was nothing that extreme. And then once you actually got through it and because I was exposed to, you know, shelling, gun rounds, slowly. So it was, you know, it's first in Kyiv was explosion somewhere around the Kyiv. You know, you heard it, but it was far away. And then you went on to see what happened actually. And then it was closer, closer, closer. And then, you know, when we went to Kharkiv, it was... Ruska Lazova, where Hartia was stationed, and you know, I was slowly exposed to the extremes, but because it was slowly, I absorbed it easier. It was not like a freak out. For me, the only freak out was when we came under shelling in Yatskivka, when we crossed the Oskil. So for me, all that came, you know, slowly, and then this thing was kind of, you know, we're in Bakhmut, we are cut out of it because that's March. 2023. Prior to that, all the conditions were kind of, you know, you could still go outside. We have this little tent outside, but Bakhmut is basically in March, it's shelled nonstop.
Yeah.
Going outside is really dangerous. So you only go outside when you actually go on ops. And to go to shit, you actually have to go from one underground, run a few meters, and go on the other underground. And that's basically, you know, you can imagine if there's a group of people living there at that time, that you could say bunker, but it was more of a like operational center. We had about 40 to 50 guys living there. And, you know, and it's a new experience in life.
Yeah, it's okay. A moment where you say, well, this is for sure, it's real.
This is Ritz-Carlton Bakhmut style. Yeah.
Yeah, how the hell has it come to this? What, when you describe that... you said the moment of shelling, there was a bit of a freak out. What was the situation?
Basically, it was the end of Izum operation, of Kharkiv operation, which basically ended somewhat after Izum.
I was just there days ago.
We actually were crossing. I was a part of an international force which was added to the 95th Brigade. And 95th was one of the battalions of 95th was tasked with cleaning the village of Yatskivka and then preparing the positions for advancing to the Rubtsi. So the recon said that, you know, the Russians were already not in that city, that they left, and that it's going to be a clean sweep. Of course, it was not a clean sweep. And then basically when we finished our part of the mission, we had a few wounded in our unit, so they've been extracted already on medvac. And we were trying to cross Oskil River, which is next to the Izum, back to the station to see our wounded. We came under artillery rounds. So the first time when we're coming in front of the bridge, we saw the artillery rounds. We went into the forest. We saw that the pontoon was blown because we saw it with our eyes. So, you know, one of the guys said, okay, we're going to swim. It's September. It's pretty cold, I would say. I said, guys, I mean, whoa, wait a minute. I mean, I understand everything, but swimming is a bit different beast.
This is that river Izum is right on this river.
Izum is basically, yes. You cross the bridge Ponton, but it's higher up to Izum, and this is a bit lower.
Okay.
How do you say it?
Down river,
yeah, whatever. And so we could theoretically go up, but we didn't know what the situation there. So we only knew this sector. So there was a decision or an option of swimming. And I said, guys, wait, let's see, because the shelling was ongoing. And then we saw a car passing by. I stopped and asked him, like, where did you came from? He said, from the other side. But we saw the pontoon blow over and said, no, it was just a scratch. You can still go over. So we jumped back into the armored vehicle and started to drive, and we were approaching the pontoon, and the artillery rounds came again. So my calculation now that they had some sort of an eye in the sky, which knew that the, you know, the transport is coming in. So we had one landed about 3 meters behind us, which hopped us. Everybody slammed their heads. And then the next one landed literally a meter and a half in front of us. So all of the blow went to the front glass and, you know, shattered. We were pretty lucky. We had a decent APV. It was this Rochelle's, Canadian, I think. So basically we got blown in off the road into the kind of sidewalk or real forest, I would say. So we disembarked quickly, one side to one side of the road, the other to the other. In the forest, of course, there was plenty of
mines.
Small ones. So we basically crossed the other. We were running about from artillery rounds for about another 2 hours from one, cellar to another cellar. That was, I think, for me, so far, the most scary experience. Since that, of course, there was shelling coming in, but I think the first time is the worst because you have no chance of doing anything. You even don't flip. You know, there's one coming in and then a second later, second lens, and it could land if, you know, half a second or a quarter of a second we were driving too fast, it would land in us and it's done. I mean, the direct hit, we would not withstand. So,
like,
yeah.
Going too fast or going too slow, you can't control. Which would be best.
And yeah. We were also lucky because we had two vehicles within the unit. Mm. So there was 10 guys in armored and there was 4 guys in a medvac. But because our medic took the keys from medvac with him when he was taking out the guys, we took only one car because we couldn't. If we were to be two cars, some would get hit.
Yeah, just too much yeah. real estate.
No, because just yeah. that 3 meters behind us, yeah. that would be the other car.
So it's somebody,
yeah,
luck.
Yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, just luck that we didn't have the keys from that car and we were driving in one.
And you're, so for several, couple of hours, you're going into abandoned houses or destroyed houses.
Yeah, just in the cellars of these houses.
And this, to top it off, because you would thought that this village is already cleared. So yeah. you were expecting something calmer.
Well, the thing is that you're expecting artillery. Oops, you're expecting artillery rounds, but you don't expect any man fire in there. Of course, that changed dramatically once we were in the city. But when we got hit, it was already on retreat, so it was maybe one kilometer from the actual gunfights. Mm. And that's when they start shelling because Russians didn't want that more reinforcements come in, so they're trying to destroy that chain of reinforcing coming through.
But eventually, I guess, because they were retreating, that subsided. This came to an end because, like, on that particular day, because the Russians were pulling away.
On that particular day, it didn't stop. I mean, the 95th actually cleared the city, but with problems because we were tasked with a small piece of land which we had to clear because we had a small group. 95th had 3 platoons there. 2 were actually going to the city and 1 was reserved. And they actually had to use that reserve because there was a small setup which caused a lot of injuries and unfortunate lethal injuries. So they actually been fighting there for all day. We had some tanks which we lost and the Russians' tanks were still in the region. They were still working. So it was war is chaotic. We only see it in the movies as, everybody's on the walkie-talkies, everybody know where they are, what they're doing. Nah, the war is, especially in Ukraine, is a completely different because we don't have anything in the sky. So the sky is dominated by Russians and their planes doing a shitload of damage. I mean, it's really scary when a 500 kilos explosive from a guided missile from an airplane coming near you. It's like, you really feel it even when you're like 200 meters away. It goes through your bones. So, and because they dominate, that's a whole different level. Of course, we have more modern equipment, the Stingers, the Endless, but it's very hard when you fight against such a massive, massive force.
And still, it was that, September 2020.
And
that was a huge, ended up being that was a time of great success for Ukraine, taking back that region, the Kharkiv region.
Yeah, it was a massive operation. And unfortunately for us at that time, if we would have more troops, we would go further. Yeah. The only problem is that we had some of our regiments and some of our brigades were nonstop marching for 2.5 days. They were just out of power. They just, if we would have had that third wave, we would most likely end up in Luhansk because they were running. we just didn't have enough manpower to keep on pushing. They were all, I mean, they were dead. I mean, physically dead and emotionally. I mean, imagine not sleeping two nights and constantly pushing on and constantly clearing up city by city, city by city. It's just too hard.
So, but for manpower, it could have been even more.
Yeah. No, it's not even about the manpower. It's about that, you know, when you have a battalion, it needs to ride on something. It cannot go on foot 200 kilometers.
Yeah.
And when you don't have that, APVs, tanks, BTRs, you just cannot, you know, you cannot send people in buses to go to the front line. So that was, at that time, a key problem for us. We did not have enough equipment, military.
When you talk with your colleagues, your soldier colleagues now, what do you feel? What is the thing they need the most?
Ooh, well, the thing is that everything we needed yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, the thing is everything we got. I'm not gonna be, you know, I'm super appreciative that the world is helping us. You know, but in the face of, they need to understand that it's not some local thing. It's a massive problem that Russia is not going to stop in Ukraine. Russia wants to destroy Ukraine. Russia wants to terminate Ukrainians. That's like they set their goal. They want to denazify Ukraine, but denazifying Ukraine means killing all the Ukrainians. They're not going to stop because their idea is, you know, getting back to Berlin, getting back to the post-World War II grounds, which mean Poland, Baltic countries, you know, etc. The world doesn't feel it. You know, they felt it a little bit in the beginning, but now they say, no, but Russia will never going to do it. I mean, Russia is going to do it. And unless they're going to stop in Ukraine or they lose in Ukraine or Russia cease existence, the threat will always be there because it's not about one person who is trying, you know, to mingle. And we're talking about they already lost about, 350,000, 400,000 soldiers. And they're not coming. They still keep coming, new, fresh ones. So we're talking about the general idea of the population of Russia is okay to kill people. Is okay to go back and attack Europe. Is okay to send rockets and missiles into the civilian cities. They are basically showing in the state TV that their nuke rockets will reach London in 200 seconds, Berlin in 180 seconds. And they're actually showing it and they're preparing their population that they will do it. And the population is not saying, no, don't do it. They say, yeah, let's kill everybody. Let's dominate the world. That's fucking wrong.
And we see this every day, of course.
Yeah. And in Ukraine, we see it every day.
Yeah. Especially the cities that, you know, Kyiv is well protected by Patriot missiles, and Lviv, but cities, you know, Odessa, Kharkiv, and all the cities that have been destroyed.
Yeah, well.
What do you, Sergei, do you speak much with your old opponents and colleagues in the world of professional tennis about this? You know, are they paying attention to what's happening here? Do you have much communication with them? Or is there an awareness of...
There is awareness. I've talked to a lot of them in the first month. You know, I've received, honestly, I'm going to scroll back in my phone at a time and I'm definitely going to forget or I didn't answer to some of them because there were just way too many messages. It's not about only my current or past colleagues. It was people who played before me, people who already... with coaches or ATP employees, you know, WTA players, a lot. And I'm really grateful for their support and, you know, that they care. But I also understand it's not their war. You know, every time I reached out, they always say, oh, how are you? And they're all understanding their own situation. But on the other hand, the war is in Ukraine. And it's us who's supposed to fight, and we are fighting. So, you know, I know that they are for Ukraine. Maybe... they don't put it out every day on their social media, and I would never want them because they live a peaceful life and they want to have a peaceful life. And it's not up to them whether their government is going to give us weapons or not. But I'm sure that if that would be up to them, they would give us. So it is a very, I would say, strange situation right now where the world is going to get tired of all the Ukraine war. The politicians are starting to build up their political careers based on what they say about Ukraine, whether we're not going to give Ukraine any more support, we're not going to give them any money. And some of the people say, yeah, you know, that means that we will have more money in our country. And they build up. That's very short-term politics, I would say, you know, because, yeah, not giving Ukraine money and armory now basically puts your sons and your kids into the war in about 5 years from now. Good luck.
Yeah, just realize and read the history. As I'm thinking about you're telling these stories of your intense battles in Izum. And Izum means raisin.
Yeah.
Version of a grape, the sad version of a grape, you could say, or the like
appassimento.
Yeah, we're like, it's just kind of like ironic in a sense, because there you are in a Zoom, yeah, crawling around under fire, and you have this beautiful vineyard in Zakopatia.
Yeah,
and from, I've been to that vineyard from the point from your tasting room. It's on the other side of the Carpathians. It's a different climate. It's sunnier than it is, say, in Galicia or Lviv. It's a beautiful place, and you can see from your tasting room Romania
and Hungary.
And yes. Hungary, and so it's this point where these nations come together, and you make amazing wines. I tried your experimental. It was back then experimental, the Traminer
orange
wine, but all you have your ace wines, the Merlot and the Cabernet, which you see all over Ukraine, and fantastic stuff. And I. So there you were in Izum, the town, you know, named after the raisin, and you're also a great wine visionary. What's your story with wine? How did you?
Oh, it's a very long one. I'm not sure we're going to be able to cover it here, but basically I didn't drink alcohol at all. I didn't like alcohol. The taste of alcohol just doesn't fit me. But I fortunately accepted an invitation from a club in Bordeaux, Villa Primrose, one of the most, I would say, oldest clubs in France. It's about 127 years old, and it's a very especially, I would say, cool club in a way that about 400 members, half of them are winemakers, wine merchants, negotiants, journalists, enologists. So basically the whole of the Bordeaux Mecca of winemaking is the members of the club, and I came there, I never drank wine prior to that. So it was all the transformation which I got from them basically led me to starting my project. The love for wine came from the people who actually are loving wine. So it was kind of an easy for me to jump into that ship.
And you realize that there are, you know, in Ukraine, I mean, because I think a lot of probably wine culture had been destroyed during Soviet times. But you realize that there's the climate and the soil here, it was conducive to
I was an amateur.
Yeah.
The only thing I was attached to was history. Uh-huh. And Zakarpattia, and basically that region in Berhove, is the region where, during the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the wines were very famous. Because the plant, the wines itself, they were planted from the Tokaj region, which is only 60 kilometers away from where we are.
In Hungary.
Yeah. So for me, it was the history which led me there. You know, the history of that region, the history of that soil. And then, of course, after that, I started to understand, you know, oh, okay, Zakarpattia is a special place in Ukraine in general. Our first vintage, if you're going to find it ever, I'm not sure you're going to find it ever, it doesn't carry the region, because the locals told us, if you put Zakarpattia, you will never sell your wine, because, you know, it's meant to no good. And only from the second vintage, we started to actually put the Zakarpattia region on, because we wanted to share that where we are from. We wanted to tell that, you know, Zakarpattian wines are good. They can be actually great, exceptionally great, etc. So, you know, I came to the winemaking in Ukraine from the very posh establishment of Bordeaux, because they are, I would say, entrepreneurs in winemaking. Even now, when we say, oh, you know, they're all traditional, there's nothing traditional how they do wines inside. Yes, there's a very traditional way of growing the wines. But once it gets into the winery, I mean, they are exceptional in terms of how to extract, whether it's fermentation in concrete batten or in steel, or fermentation in oak or in glass. I mean, they experiment in such ways that I never dreamt of, you know. And I'm still, every time I go back there, or I was going back there, I was excited, of what small details they're thinking in order to make it better. And then I come to Ukraine, where wine is not a commodity. It's a business. You know, you just, you know, you put any juice into the bottle, you sell it. That's basically how it goes. And that there are only few players in the winemaking which were small, which were actually doing the thing that we are trying to do. You know, and we kind of grouped together, and we started to push in a different direction. We started to push in the direction of quality, in the direction of history, in the direction of what we're trying to sell. We were explaining why we do it and how we do it, and, you know, why it's taken this way. Because, and the feedback from Ukrainians was very positive. Every time we did any degustation, or the people after, they start to drink Ukrainian wine. But if you take the Ukraine at that time, was 40 million people. And my best, I would say, degustation in Ukraine was about 40 people or 45 because, you know, the restaurants can only set that much people. It's a very long process to get everybody on board. But we knew that the road is hard. We knew that the road is, complicated, but we still took it because we believe that it's a great opportunity.
And how is the business of making wine in the wartime? I mean, I do know, for example, I mean, I've been in some scary places, and if I can find in some shop, Stokowski Ace wine, I'm like, okay, this is a good thing to have on hand during a missile attack. What is your strategy and vision now?
We were superbly lucky, or I would say we were saved by our partners abroad. So we had a deal signed with Japanese exporter or importer in Japan of wine. He came in September 2021, and we signed the deal. But the order never came. They're very meticulous about the way they do business, and you really have to tick all the boxes prior to your wine getting to Japan. And then in March 2022, they send an email. We would like to order a bulk of wine. Not only us, also other wineries across Ukraine, which were still kind of having wine. And I remember we're like, okay, guys, wait. I mean, the war is on, the borders are closed. Nobody's allowing their containers. International companies do not ship from Ukraine because they don't allow their containers. The cars cannot go, so the cargo doesn't work. I mean, we had no idea how to do it. But we signed up for it. We took different wineries from Ukraine, gathered up in our winery because we in Zakarpattia was the safest place. And basically all kind of, jam it together and send it off. We remember we drove the car from Ukraine to Poland, and in Poland went on into the container, and then it was shipped to Japan. And then, we had a story with Estonian. We have very good partners in Estonia, which are remarkable guys. They just came in on a minibus with some humanitarian aid, like diapers, baby food and stuff like this. And they came to a wine and said, okay, we want to take a pallet of your wine and try to sell it, kind of to support Ukraine in an economical way. And I'm like, guys, but, you're just a minivan. You're not going to get out because, you need a license to actually drive the goods. But, they went on and they find a transportation company, and it started, and they've been really, really incredibly supportive, and they did incredible stuff with Ukrainian wine in hours as well. And I'm extremely thankful to them for that, what they did. And Estonia in general, the way they support Ukraine is just massive. So, and through this period of time, because in Ukraine it was a curfew on alcohol, you couldn't buy anything. The alcohol was not sold.
The first few months of the full scale.
Six months. So it really helped us to get through that process. And then eventually, those contract sites, and we started to sell it back to Ukrainians a little bit. And it's a still slow process where you build up, but, we are happy. Well, happy, which is the wrong way. We are super lucky to be in Zakarpattia. That decision was basically crucial because I got offers from different regions to go there. But the other regions like Trubetskoy is destroyed. Baykush, which for me is one of the best wineries in Ukraine, I visited them during the full scale. 2 days prior when I went to Izum, I was in Ochakiv.
And this is in southern Ukraine.
That's Mykolaiv. Mykolaiv.
That's on the Black Sea.
Yeah, on the Black Sea. And basically Ochakiv has been bombarded, from day one, because there's a, center of marine forces. Mm. And they are in like 3 kilometers past Ochakiv in Chornomork, or how they call it, the village. Basically on the shoreline, there's a small lagoon. Mm. They have a winery on one side and the wine grapes on the other. And I came to see, I was passing by to Izum, so I came to visit, I saw the winemaker. She put me in one of these houses, which I had for a tourist build up. And it's a beautiful small cottage with a massive glass window in front. And there's just, like a small living room and a small bedroom. But the glass is overlooking the lagoon and into the parts of Black Sea and into the territory which is held by Russia, because it's on the other side of Dnieper River. That's the valley where it comes. And every morning, you have rockets flying over your head, and I wake up 6 a.m. and I hear there's noise, and I get out and I see literally rockets flying over, and I call the winemaker and say, what the fuck? She's like, don't worry, every day same shit. It's going to land somewhere behind us, either Odessa or in Mykolaiv or somewhere, but every day like this. I'm like, shit.
Amazing how you adjust and get used to that stuff.
They would just be working with
and
it.
And they're still working, because I see their wines.
Yeah, they're working, they're operational, and they're actually doing great wines. But, I mean, the circumstances in which we are, we all try to survive. Of course, the world is taking it, you know, kind of for granted, but nothing is for granted in Ukraine right now.
Could you, as we close on this, as... You know, I think as I've traveled this country, and every American I know who's come to Ukraine is so inspired by the people they meet as they travel the country, and they don't want to leave Ukraine. They love being here. It's a place of inspiration and encouragement. And you know, in America, we love self-help. You know, like you have like the people that take ice baths every morning. You know, all the tech entrepreneurs and all that. And you know, here you take missile baths. You know, it's wish for it, but you got rockets over your head. How you? As a professional athlete, world-class athlete, as a soldier, and as an entrepreneur, how do you, I mean, obviously this takes a toll, right? And you have kids, and you know your kids are often far away, I imagine. And how, like, what's your strategy for, you know, every day when you wake up? How do you stay like fit and focused? And maybe within that context, like, what has been your darkest, most difficult moment in all this? And how do you keep your mind stable and sharp and focused?
Well, it's hard for me to judge my mental state by myself, you know. But I definitely acknowledge that I've become more, I wouldn't say strict, I would say less tolerant would be the right way. So my boiling point becomes significantly lower, or just coming up faster. Because you don't accept certain things, and you just, you know, you don't want to deal with it because you are under a tremendous amount of pressure throughout the other things. So, you know, you just don't want to kind of absorb the negativity, which you don't have to. It is, you know, daily life, I don't know how you wake up. I mean, back in 2022, my daily life was just, you know, planned on the next day. I never planned ahead of one day. From the time I returned, because you didn't know whether the next day is going to happen. So, you know, always, okay, the next day, okay, we'll see what next day is going to bring. Right now, of course, you're already adjusted to the war and you're trying to plan a bit ahead. I'm not planning very far ahead because I honestly still don't understand whether I will be able to live through this war or not, and as many of my countrymen. But it got a bit easier. And the only thing which helped me to get through this process is basically my professional tennis career, because the mental stress you endure there, it's kind of mental stress also here, and you kind of trying to cope with it. But apart from the mental part, I would say maybe physical part helps a little bit, because I was fit to do stuff, and I'm fit to, you know, wake up every day, whether it's 3 a.m. or it's 6 p.m. You know, you're able to do stuff which you need to do. But I don't have the mix. I'm just trying to be, you know, I'm just trying to live a life here when we're not on the front line, as normal as I can, but understanding and knowing that the war is in the country, that daily people are dying, daily soldiers are dying, and every day something might happen, and, you know, everything can change in one day. But still trying to be, you know, sort of positive or normal within the borders of my own morality, I would say.
Is there, like, any comparison whatsoever in your mind or in your spirit, like, to the intense moments, like the moment when you were defeating the defending champion of Wimbledon, Federer, which is an extraordinary thing that most people can't imagine, right? Even tennis players can't imagine, you know, even top tennis players can't imagine that. Is there any connection in your spirit or mind to being in these extreme circumstances, you know, with your friends and your fellow soldiers fighting? Any similarity, or is it totally, totally different things?
Totally different things. I would say, because when you win, so basically beating Federer or winning one of my four singles titles, it's euphoria. You know, it's a positive emotion, outburst of that positive emotion, because, you know, that happened. Here, honestly, like hitting a tank or even the Russians and killing them doesn't give you that, because it's not euphoria, it's just a daily routine. So I guess maybe if we all live through it and we wait until that victory day, you know, no matter for who takes it what, but for me, like, let's say it's dissolvement of Russia as a state, because once this don't exist, there's no threat. if there's a different ruler, but, you know, same country is same shit. Maybe when that is going to happen, maybe that euphoria is going to be able to match that which I had in my tennis career.
Wow. Sorry. Diakoyu, wait, do you still play tennis? Do you find time in the war to?
I'm very lucky that my commander, or actually our statute of the security service, allows us to take part in volunteer sport events, which means I still try when I'm back in Kyiv once a week. I play 2 hours with the next generation. And last year, me and Elena Svitolina, we organized through her foundation a tour of events for the kids, and we're actually going to do it this year again, but on a bigger scale. And actually tomorrow I'm for 1 day off to Lviv, where we have a masterclass for about 450 kids, which came all over from Ukraine to play tennis with us. So that, I would say we are just trying to give back to the sport, which gave us a lot, and trying still to give our next generation, which we're not able to leave because there's many of the tennis families that left Ukraine and they are settled in a different countries. But we really want to also help the ones who stayed and tell them that there's still a chance, there's still a way, you know, if they work hard enough and if they try to become the best of themselves, they still can make it big in tennis. And that's basically the message why we're doing this stuff.
Not to give up on the dreams of peaceful Victoria.
Yeah, because that's everything that they still live, you know, they're in bomb shelters in the morning, but they still can kind of practice in the afternoon. And still believing that even in those very hard and very harsh circumstances in their lives, they still can make it through. They still can be great tennis players. They still can be the tennis stars.
Well, Serhii Sakovsky, duže
diakuju.
Diakuju. Tennis champion, winemaker, soldier from Izum to the vineyards. Thank you for sharing these stories with us. And I hope many people who watch get to try your fantastic wines.
Hopefully, yeah. We actually start sales in the States. We have, I actually have a phone call with Wine Spectator tomorrow. I think we're launching it in the States.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, we have a distributor finally. So
we'll spread the word. And
please do.
And this has been Joe Lindsley with our Land of the Free podcast with Ukrainska Pravda here in the studios in Kyiv. I speak every single weekday of Russia's full-scale invasion until victory on Chicago's WGN Radio. You can follow our work at UkrainianFreedomNews.com, and we welcome support for supplies for the front lines. Anyway, this is Joe Lindsley, Serhii Sakovsky from Kyiv. Until victory.
Slava Ukraini.
Heroim Slava.